The second time I nearly got shot was the day John Henry Doc Holliday showed up.
It's a long, hard road to the glory land. I'm starting my good work now. Spirit's gonna take me by the hand if I start my praying now.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with novelist Frank Thurmond about his book, Lottie Dino, a novel of the Civil War and the American Southwest.
I've always been fascinated by what you might call the myth of the West. You know, some of the very first movies, earliest silent films, captured the aura of the Old West and the way that it's been mythologized with these legendary characters. And in many ways, what I discovered about Lottie Dino is that she fits that characterization.
Lottie Dino, Doc Holliday, the American West, and writer Frank Thurmond on Arts and Letters.
It was a busy night at the Beehive Saloon in Fort Griffin, Texas, on a crisp spring evening in 1868. For certain reasons I will return to later, I had found myself there following a time of drifting after that unfortunate incident in San Antonio. I will come back to that, too.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with writer Frank Thurmond about his historical novel, Lottie Dino, a book about Americana, filled up with just about everything. The Civil War, riverboats, sunken towns, epic card games, gunfights, love triangles, and at the center of it all, a lady gambler.
Ghosts will speak to me in dreams and the eyes of creatures. I sing the songs that come along through strange enchanting teachers.
When she arrives in these places, she actually has connections through her father to help her get started. And it's those connections in Detroit, for example, and later in New Orleans, that actually give her an opportunity to gamble, to have a position in a local club. These were gentlemen's clubs, and it was unusual to have a woman gambler. A so-called lady gambler was hard to come by, but when they could participate and play poker well, then they were quite popular. So it certainly brought in business and could make a lot of money for individual clubs such as that. So that's how she gets a start and gets a name and is able to travel around, ends up in San Antonio at the university club that was owned by Frank Thurmond and his brothers, and is given a position there, and that's how she meets Frank, and right. That's how that relationship begins.
The demons are hot on my trail tonight, but my mind is calm and my heart is light. 12 burning moons, it's been a long year, but I won't disappear.
Frank Thurmond, short story writer, memoirist, novelist, poet, screenwriter. Welcome to Arts and Letters.
Thank you, Brad. It's good to be here again.
All right, Frank. This is an odd story because what we have is your name is Frank Thurmond, and one of the main characters in this novel is Frank Thurmond.
Right.
And the protagonist would be Lottie Dino. So tell us how this all came about. You were looking to see this character named Frank Thurmond, who you'd heard about, and you kind of wanted to see historically what type of a figure he was. So just give us a sense of how this came about.
Well, interestingly, a lot of it came about right here in this studio when I was visiting one time, and your wife, co-producer on the show, Mary Ellen, mentioned that she had come across a Frank Thurmond from the 19th century who popped up when she had was looking up some of my work online, and she said she kept seeing this 19th century photograph of a figure named Frank Thurmond, but couldn't find any more details about him. I had actually heard that from several other people in the past and had always been curious about this and had looked him up myself. And Mary Ellen said, you know, if you're looking for a project to write about, you should write a novel about Frank Thurmond based on this similar name, this 19th century figure. So that planted the seed, really, and I took that with me, and it wasn't long before the pandemic, so it really became a pandemic project where I started researching the story and trying to find out what I could about this mysterious figure with my name. And it turned out that really the only thing he was famous for was that he married this woman named Lottie Dino, a very famous figure in her time as a lady gambler, as she was called. And there's an incredible story around her. And so she had married Frank Thurman, but really the whole story was about her. And I realized pretty quickly the story is not about Frank Thurman. I was going to write about this guy with my name, but it's really about this fascinating woman. And the story needed to be about her. And he happens to come into the story. So that's what led to finding this bigger story about this fascinating woman from the 19th century and telling her story in a way that had not been done before.
My tale begins in Kentucky, on a large plantation near the small Ohio River port town of Warsaw in Gallatin County. I was born in 1844 on the 21st of April. That makes me a proud Taurus, and I have always lived up to it. They called me Charlotte J. Tompkins at birth, though I went by Carlotta, and have sported quite a few different sobriquets in the years since.
So, she's known in San Antonio as the Angel of San Antonio. And then when she reaches Fort Concho, she comes up with a new name, with a new handle for herself. She calls herself Maud, and then later became known as Mystic Maud, and is still remembered to this day as Mystic Maud, you know, in San Angelo. Now, the most famous name in the title of the novel comes from when she's in Fort Richardson, and she's looking for Frank, and she's found out where he is finally. But she's in a game, a high-stakes faro game, or poker game, perhaps, and a Mexican bystander says, "Señorita, with winnings like them, you ought to call yourself Lata Dinero." And she thinks about that, and she comes up with Lottie from Carlotta, common name for Charlotte or Carlotta, and she comes up with Lottie Dino, based on that. And that's where her famous sobriquet of Lottie Dino comes from, and is known by that to this day.
My parents were relatively well-to-do and owned, though I am now terribly ashamed to admit it, a large number of enslaved people. One of these plays an important part in my story. Her name was Mary Poindexter, a young woman who was assigned my nanny at birth and who would later become my closest friend and confidant, not to mention my protector on our many adventures together, in a friendship that would endure long after she finally obtained her free papers.
The demons are hot on my trail tonight, but my mind is calm and my heart is light. 12 burning moons, it's been a long year, but I won't disappear.
The book begins with her on the Kentucky plantation, and she has a maid who looks after her, Mary, and Mary's 7 feet tall. Historically, in dealing with something that's pre-Civil War, and then, of course, we have slavery, it's Kentucky, I know that you had to deal with some difficult issues for us to imagine now. How, as a researcher and as a writer, did you handle dealing with topics that are very difficult, because Mary is very close to her, but she's still enslaved by her for a little while until Lottie sets her free.
Yes, that was certainly one of the most challenging aspects of writing this and wanting to keep it authentic at the same time. And one thing that really helped and facilitated that was the structure I found, which was to have the story told in Lottie's voice, but looking back and writing it as a kind of memoir, which was very challenging, of course, for me as a male writer to do and to try to make authentic. But I've gotten some wonderful feedback on the work that I've done that gives me hope that it does work. But having established that structure, I'm able to have a voice of an experienced, wise woman who is looking back on what she's learned in the course of her life. And so when she tells the story of that earlier part of her life, she makes it clear that in later life she realizes the evil of slavery and how much she was naive at the time in accepting it, but at the same time captures this real genuine friendship she had with Mary, who was somewhat older and was her nanny on the plantation.
And always had her back.
Always had her back, and is sent with her when she travels to Detroit to get away from the dangers of the war that has broken out. Kentucky was neutral at the time, but her father had joined the Confederacy, and the Union Army was coming close to occupying Warsaw, Kentucky, where she lived. So Mary goes with her, and there's a clear friendship and a clear bond. And as soon as they get to Detroit, Lottie, still called Carlotta at the time, frees her, realizes that we're now in a free territory, and sets her free. And yet the friendship remains. They continue traveling together, but she makes it clear that no matter what happens with the war, she's going to ensure that Mary's freedom stays intact. And the friendship continues for a significant part of the story after that.
And her father is pretty rich. What does he do for a living? Because he takes her on all kinds of trips. He takes her to Europe.
Yes, well, he owns horses and he has a racetrack, and a lot of his business outside of the plantation is traveling around the United States and also abroad, selling horses, trading horses, and so forth. And that's why he has connections in Detroit and in New Orleans and different places, so that when she arrives in these places, she actually has connections that, through her father to help her get started. And it's those connections in Detroit, for example, and later in New Orleans, that actually give her an opportunity to gamble.
I saw Daddy in action as a gambler when he took me with him to many of the most famous casinos in the world. My father could hold his own with some of the most notorious gamblers of the day. I owe a great debt to my father for teaching me to flip the pasteboards, along with all the tricks of the trade he knew when I was still just a young girl. By the time I was 16, I could play cards, especially poker, and hold my own with the best of them.
I must have thought I was a lucky gambler, always blowing on your dice. Going and showing you my hand, I guess I should have thought about it twice. I never rolled those double sevens, never got a royal flush. I guess I better find something steady, cause it looks like I'm out of luck.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with author Frank Thurmond as he talks about his novel, Lottie Dino.
Hey, Diamond has been hiding, buried in the earth, all went under constant pressure.
What were you doing down at the track today, Missy?
Daddy was staring at me across the table with stern eyes. Mama looked up surprised, while my little sister Ellie Mae giggled. We were just feeding Ginger, Daddy.
But why were you there in the first place?
Well, I paused a moment trying to think up a good alibi. My sister giggled again as she waited gleefully for Daddy's and my reaction. I remembered the old saying that honesty is the best policy, and decided to put it to the test for once. Trying my best to ignore my sister, I attempted a feeble smile at Daddy.
But why were you there in the first place?
I go there to play cards with the jockeys. They like to play poker with matchsticks during their afternoon break and let me play with them. I wanted to practice all those tricks you taught me. Mama looked at me concerned, while Daddy just sat still and expressionless. Ellie Mae looked like she was about to offer further comment, but mercifully stayed quiet. Daddy asked again.
What were you doing with the golden boy alone at the stable?
He said firmly. This took me by surprise. I did not understand what I had done wrong. What's wrong with Johnny? I thought you did business with his family in Boston.
Business, yes, and strictly that.
But Daddy...
You do not associate with that boy further. Do you hear? You need to find a nice, rich, Southern and Christian boy, like us all, who will marry you and help manage this plantation one day when it's yours.
We all keep a list of reasons to extinguish a burning love. Fire's wild and needs constant tending. Nothing ever is enough.
Because there is this love interest, there's this young man that she had met back home in Kentucky, named Johnny Golden, and she has a real crush on him, and he really has a crush on her as well. It's reciprocated, but she is thrown for a loop when her father says, you can't associate with that boy. She says, why? He says, well, he's Jewish. And she doesn't understand why that would be a problem, but it doesn't fit the plan that her parents have laid out for her. She's supposed to marry a local man, Protestant. So he actually works for her father and is a jockey on the racetrack. But then he joins up to fight in the war, and they aren't able to meet again until he meets her in Detroit. And so at that point, he's in the war, but he tells her, meet me in San Antonio, because that's the gateway to the West, that is going where everything's happening. From there, we'll go out west to California and find our gold and so forth. So he's the one who gives her the idea to meet up in San Antonio, and she just has to find her way to get there. And he says after the war, he promises he'll meet her there. And that's what leads her to book passage on the steamboat with Mary. And the first destination is New Orleans, because that is the place, being a free town that's Union occupied, where she plans to stay until she can then go west to San Antonio, the idea being that she'll meet up with Johnny Golden.
And we cannot know the future until
passage for myself and Mary on a shiny new paddle wheel, triple deck stern wheeler, christened the New Orleans, after Robert Fulton's first commercial steamboat 50 years earlier. One cold but sunny morning in early spring 1863, I found myself starting up the boarding gangplank with Mary. We must have been some sight, too. A petite 19-year-old girl with flaming red sunlit locks climbing the platform with an ebony giant of a woman by my side and lugging our own respective baggage, too.
Time is passing through some
Everything's going along pretty well. She's on her way to becoming a kind of a socialite like her sister, Ellie. I'm sorry, I'm smiling because Ellie was also the name of your dog.
That's right.
Yeah, and I love that you did this, Frank, and it's nice, just kind of an insider's view. You put names in this as homages to a lot of people. One would be Charles Portis, author of True Grit. Another would be your brother. I just love that you did that, these little homages to folks. As a historian, but a novelist too, how did you work up the courage to not change the story, but play with it a little bit?
Well, you mentioned my brother, for example. Yeah, especially once I established that the Thurmond family I'm writing about is the same Thurmond family as my own, I realized it was a chance to have an homage to my brother and my mother, mm-hmm. Both of whom died in recent years. So I changed the name of Frank's younger brother to Will, which was the name of my late brother who died tragically young while I was writing the novel. So I had him in the novel as a character. I'm able to make reference to my mother, Barbara Thurmond. And that just was very moving for me to be able to do that. And now they're in the story. You mentioned Charles Portis, for example. In many ways, this project was inspired by getting to know Charlie as I knew him at the Faded Rose here in Little Rock. And afterwards, I dropped by there regularly, you know, for the next 2 years, and even sort of became welcome into his little group that he had of locals. And Charlie would tell his stories, and it was very inspiring. And then it turned out one day that my dad, when he heard that I'd gotten to know Charles Portis, he said, well, ask him if he ever went by the name Buddy, because I always wondered, since I, in 1957, used to hang out and drink beer with a Buddy Portis in Fayetteville while a student there. The place was called George's Majestic Lounge. So the next time I saw Charlie, I said, well, did you ever go by Buddy? He said, that's what they used to call me, Buddy. And turned out that he was the same one, that my dad had been drinking with Charlie almost 50 years earlier, and there I am with him at that time. And at the same time, I finally read True Grit for the first time. When I finished it, I just thought, if only I had a story that I could write that was set during this period. And so later, all these years later, when the Frank Thurmond character led me to this story with Lottie Dino, I was able to write a story in the vein, at least, I hope, of True Grit.
Frank, would you read for us?
At La Rose Fanny, there was an old regular who used to sit at the bar telling tales. His name was Charlie, but his friends called him Buddy. From Buddy, I learned a whole lot of history, though how true it was I never knew, about the Texas and Arkansas frontier. His vivid descriptions of the gritty characters and landscape there filled me with the desire to go see it all for myself. Yet it was when he spoke of his experiences in the Mexican War that Buddy waxed especially emotional. One evening, he told the story of a time when he and a fellow soldier became separated from the company of Texas Rangers in which they were serving. They hiked along the Rio Grande near Laredo and came across an abandoned village in which the only structure still standing amidst a wasteland of smoldering rubble was an old Spanish mission. Upon the plaza before it lay countless bodies, many of them women and children, and the two men were sickened by the smell of rotting flesh. Buddy and his comrade sought shelter in the mission and spent a restless night amongst the stench and the tumult of distant battle. The next morning, as they stepped warily outside and prepared to resume the search for their company, there was a blast of nearby cannon fire, followed by an explosion just behind them. They instinctively fell to the ground and covered their heads. When they looked up again, they saw that the church from which they had just emerged was now but a smoking pile of rubble. At that, Buddy abruptly ceased his tale and went silent. He would say no more that night, and he seldom spoke of his war experiences again. When it came to describing war experiences that I don't have personally, I remembered stories that had been told to me by those who had. And my own grandfather actually was a World War I soldier. He was born in 1896 and lived to almost 100, and I got to know him up until my college years. I'd been told that throughout most of his life, he did not talk about his World War I experiences, but at the end of his days, he did. He kept a journal during his time in the war. In the trenches that he let me see. The story that he actually told often was this particular one, where he had been with a friend in a shelled-out French town and stayed in a church one night and came out, and just after stepping out of it, it blew up, it was shelled. And so that's where I imagined this scene, a story from Buddy, who is based on Charlie Portis and who was a Korean War vet and often talked about his experiences. So I thought that was an appropriate way to use that story that connected with my own grandfather.
Sees the traveling kind and they won't understand the world through his eyes and flexible plans. He wanders through genders, lovers and friends, through space and through time. Her trip never ends.
And so our vessel trudged its steady 10 miles per hour pace downstream, a relatively uneventful journey once we got past the roaring rapids at the treacherous Falls of the Ohio, just past Louisville.
There, at the same place where Lewis and Clark had once met up in 1803 to plan that famous little expedition of their own, the Ohio River drops 26 feet in the course of a mile over a rise of limestone bedrock.
At one point, our hardy captain feared the water might be too low to proceed. But once he and his crew had navigated us safely through, we continued apace
until finally meeting the mighty Mississippi, where it and the Ohio converge just south of Cairo, Illinois. At that point, the brown, sediment-laden water of the Ohio flows into the greenish water of the Mississippi River. Also green were the distant riverbanks, where luscious pine forest bounded us in on both sides.
Looking out at this beautiful scenery, I hummed an old folk ballad I had heard once in the Appalachians. Now, darling, my darling, don't tell me no lie. Tell me, where did you stay last night? In the pines, where the sun never shines. I shivered when the cold wind blowed.
Now, darling, my darling, don't tell me no lie. Tell me, where did you stay last night? In the pines, where the sun never shines. I shiver when the
Your passages of description are just beautiful. She's going down the river, of course, and she sees the town of Napoleon, which is later underwater.
That, for me, again, it was just in...
And that's an Arkansas town.
It is. I knew that in real life, she with Mary had traveled down the Mississippi River on a steamboat. And at that time, the river was mostly controlled by Union forces, so it was relatively safe to travel down. And their final destination was New Orleans, which was free at that time. So she knew that she could go there with Mary and Mary would be free. And on the way there, and this had been reported and I'd read about it in different accounts of her journey, she's in a town, and it's never specified exactly which town, but just a river town on the way, where she gets bitten by a snake.
Yeah, Mary does.
Mary gets bitten by a snake and has to be treated on the steamship. It's a very close call for Lottie.
My girl, where will you go? I'm going where the cold wind blows. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine.
I looked up just in time to see a long shape with numerous dark bands attached to Mary's hand. It was the largest such pit viper I had ever seen. It was sunning itself on the bank when I nearly stepped on it, but Mary saw it first and, after pushing me aside, threw herself upon the serpent right before it struck. The snake now dangled from her hand as she tried to free herself from the grasp of its sharp fangs. The cat-like pupils seemed to glare at her hatefully, and I knew she would now consider herself forever cursed and under the snake-eye spell.
In the pines where the sun never shines, I shiver when the cool wind blows.
But it occurred to me that the perfect place to have that would be Napoleon, Arkansas. Now, Napoleon, Arkansas, I had read about as a place that Mark Twain had described. He had loved the town, and in Life on the Mississippi, he describes how he had been traveling down, and he wanted to see the original old town, and is told by the captain it no longer exists. It had flooded. It had been right. Completely covered, and he described the eeriness, the haunting.
Of traveling over the top of the town.
Of traveling over the top of the town, and he describes what used to be there and the people he knew and so forth. And in my research, I saw that the time that she would have gone through, it was just a few years before the town was submerged. So she could have actually been in Napoleon. And so I get to take us to Napoleon, the town that only lives in sort of myth now, and have that incident take place there. So that was fun to be able to do. And then I have her, as the writer telling the story, recount how years later she read Mark Twain's account and realized that that town where she had been and had that first real adventure no longer existed.
Sees the traveling kind and they won't understand.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Frank Thurman talk about his book, Lottie Dino, a novel of the Civil War and the American Southwest. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our conversation with author Frank Thurman about his book, Lottie Dino, a novel of the Civil War and the American Southwest.
Last night while I lay fast asleep, everybody I know reflected on my shortcomings and switched from friend to foe. What'll I do? Where should I go? This test is multiple choice. I penciled every bubble in it and cannot find my voice.
There's this notion of leaving within this book. It's throughout. She leaves Kentucky, goes to Detroit. She leaves Detroit, and then she meets Frank in San Antonio. Tell us about Frank. He doesn't really appear until much later in the novel, maybe the first third. What's his background?
In my research, I've found that, and especially since I made that connection with my own Thurman family, I was able to learn a lot more about him mm-hmm. and his past, and learned that he was born in Georgia, and his father married a Cherokee woman, and they lived in the area of Georgia near the Cherokee land. And that's why his nickname was Cherokee Frank. And he has, in many ways, the appearance of a Native American. And so they had moved at the time from Georgia after the horrible Trail of Tears, and that had affected his mother's family. And they had moved to try to join some of his mother's people in Mississippi, and that's what had led to the move there. And then when the war broke out, they were just on a small farm. He and his brothers just did what everyone did at the time and joined the local Confederacy and fought in the Civil War, and eventually he was injured and captured. He ends up, in many ways, like Johnny, being traumatized from his war experience, which explains some of his unpredictable and even violent characteristics that also bothered her and allows us to understand him a little bit better. Once the war's over, then that's when she still keeps the plan of heading west to San Antonio.
They used to beat me up for always making the highest grade. Now they just pretend to smile and turn the other way.
The idea is she's going to meet Johnny, although at that point she's kind of just doing it perfunctorily. It's right. Sort of like, this was the plan. I'm going to go west. That's where I have the opportunity to find my fortunes and my dreams, and she's really started to give up hope on seeing Johnny, and she had convinced herself that she really wasn't sure that's what she wanted anyway. But in San Antonio, that's where she gets a reputation as, you know, a lady gambler who's able to hold her own and attract a lot of business, and that's ultimately where she meets Frank.
Mary sat behind me on a stool as my lookout as I dealt the cards each night at the Cosmopolitan. But Mary held her ground, and I felt all the safer for it, confident that her mere presence was enough to make any man think twice about misbehaving.
How did you handle Mary? Because she was just such a really overwhelmingly, I would say, in this book, if you say pure goodness, she was the angel of the book.
Without her, there's no doubt Lottie could never have traveled, certainly on her own. But even though they're two women, Mary being really, you know, just the reports that describe her, that she was very large and strong and intimidating.
And she would sit back there while...
Well, it's what was called a lookout, because you would be... Lottie's at the faro table, and then Mary sat behind her as a lookout, which later Lottie did for Frank, and vice versa sometimes, where you would have someone literally watching your back and watching the other players to make sure they're not cheating. And in the case of Lottie and Mary, Mary is so intimidating a figure that men hold back from perhaps harassing Lottie in the way that they would.
Since I don't smoke and I don't drink, all I do is long for one true love, a stable home in a world where I belong.
So she turns up in the same town, and then you know, he's a businessman, but he's also owns a kind of a gambling place, right? What was the name of it?
It was called the University Club.
Yeah.
Very misleading because it was really just a casino, but kind of a posh one in San Antonio at the time. You know, and again, decides that hiring a lady gambler there in an otherwise all-male environment could be very conducive to winnings.
And so he asks her if she'll come over and work for him. And she's a little reticent at first, but then she decides that she's going to do it. Why does she make that move?
She had been really intrigued by him and had asked about him and had hoped to meet him. And at one point at another casino, he comes to a rescue where she is being harassed by a real ruffian. And then he hands her his card. You know, it has his name and the University Club on it. Frank Thurman, University Club, and that's where you first see that name. After not seeing him again for some time, finally gets up the nerve to actually go to the club and introduce herself. And he remembers her, and that's what leads to his offering her a job there.
Oh, who's that girl, that pretty little girl, that girl I left behind me with the rosy cheeks and the curly hair, that girl I left behind me.
And Mary's still with her.
Mary's still with her at the time, and she says to him that, you know, there's one condition for me to work here. I have to have Mary as my lookout. She's always my lookout, and he's uncomfortable with that. He says that could be a real problem for our, you know, our clientele, but she says, without that, there's no deal. I'm not going to work here if I can't have her, and he agrees to let Mary come in and be her lookout, and that does lead to some awkward situations and racist atmosphere and so forth, but it works out.
There's a mini climactic scene. They seem to be having a pretty good life. She buys a house. Mary is a good friend. Frank and his brother are getting along well. They're thriving. And complication number 10, but big complication here. What happens in the University Club to Frank?
In writing it, I only had to go on references to the report that he killed a man in a fight in the casino and had to leave town quickly. So then I got to imagine exactly what happened, you know, what caused the fight and how did it play out.
Frank said,
"We don't cater to the likes of you."
At that, the rebel ruffian slowly pushed back his chair and stood up. He leaned over the table and said,
"Then cater to this."
His tattooed hand now held and cocked a pistol pointed directly at Frank, just inches from his face.
You could hear the proverbial pin drop in the room
as the two men stood there staring each other down.
The ruffian reached with his other hand in his pocket and extracted a plug of tobacco that he snagged with one of his pointy teeth.
He chewed it deliberately for a moment before spitting it at Frank,
upon the toe of whose boot the yellowish brown mass found purchase. "Mind the spittoon, mister,"
said Frank,
pointing with his pipe to a shiny brass spittoon where it sat nearby. "There's one by every table."
He flashed a wry smile at the other man,
then lifted his pipe back to his lips and, much to everyone's amusement,
blew a smoke ring that encircled the pistol's barrel before drifting into the man's face.
I have a setup earlier where when he first rescues her, it's when a ruffian harasses her in very serious terms. And then the same ruffian turns up at the University Club and remembers her and Mary, because Mary had really done a lot to defend Lottie in the first incident. So in this case, the ruffian turns up, you know, with a vengeance and is determined to insult Lottie and harass her and Mary. And at this point, you know, it's Frank Thurman's club. But he intervenes and it leads to his killing the ruffian.
"I reckon,"
came the reply,
"I mistook that silly head of yours for the right place to speak. Sure makes you look like a sissy."
He glanced at me and chuckled. Frank's smile sank into a frown as he drew the handkerchief from his front pocket and defied the gun in his face to stoop and wipe the spit from his boot. It struck me that he did this with his right hand. Meanwhile, he reached with his left hand behind his head to scratch his neck beneath the collar.
"I can tolerate most any kind of tomfoolery,"
said Frank.
"Impertinence, I simply cannot abide."
Quick as a hiccup, Frank drew out his Bowie knife from the hidden sheath under his jacket and slashed clean through the ruffian's gun hand at the wrist. With a quick backhand stroke, Frank now doubled back and stabbed him straight through the heart.
The thing that he was known for, Frank Thurman was known for, was always carrying, concealed, a razor-sharp Bowie knife. And so even in the face of a gun pointed at him, he manages to wield that weapon lethally. And then he's told, after killing the ruffian, that he has to leave because he might be able to argue self-defense, but nevertheless, the ruffian was part of a group of Confederate veterans who were in town and were very angry, and that there would be a vigilante group after him. So that's what led to his having to flee very quickly. Right. And then just when everything seemed to be going beautifully for him and Lottie.
He already had one foot in the stirrup when he turned back and embraced me with a kiss. Will turned politely away to give us our moment. Frank looked at me with a tenderness then that I would never forget, and I felt him slip something made of cold, round metal into my palm. I looked down and saw it was a silver locket. Frank said,
"A little something to remember me by."
As he leapt into the saddle, he added,
"I'm making for the Concho River Valley. I hear tell they're building a new fort up there at the army post along the river. Should be ripe for the picking."
"I will find you," said I.
Frank nodded affirmatively. Then he reached in a saddlebag and took out a small pocket gambler's pistol
and handed it to me. He said,
"Keep this handy wherever you are."
"But I don't..."
"Will can teach you."
He looked at Will, who nodded.
"And one more thing. I shall be traveling by an alias. Keep an ear out for the name Fogarty."
And when the earth was cold again, she'd find the love she once knew. She'd say, "I see..."
Now with Mary, Mary is really her true companion.
And Mary's been there from the beginning. It's the only tie to her real family.
That's right. And she actually wants Mary to go with her. She tries to get Mary to travel with her. But Mary at that point has found happiness in San Antonio. I have a scene in the novel where you have General Granger who announces the proclamation that all slaves are free.
Right.
And word comes to San Antonio that slaves have finally been freed everywhere, including Texas, and that is the official, in many ways, end of the war, and leads to celebration in the streets and the first Juneteenth celebration. And Mary and Lottie celebrate that together. And afterwards, during the time they're in San Antonio, Mary makes friends with former slaves. She finds a vocation helping orphans from the war find homes and feed them. And so she tells Lottie that she's going to stay, that she feels like she's where she wants to be. And, you know, a very powerful parting. And then later in the story, you know, Lottie just looks back and just wishes that she could have somehow kept in touch, or wishes that she could have somehow maintained her friendship with Mary, but only can hope that she continued to be happy. And it isn't until after she's left San Antonio to follow Frank up into the wilds of Texas and the frontier forts that she gets word from his brother Will Thurman that Johnny has been asking about her and is pursuing her. And she finally gets a letter that he had sent saying that he had managed to be freed from the prison he had been in after the war and his plan coming to look for in San Antonio. And now she definitely doesn't want to see him.
Yeah, help me with that moment. I mean, she really turns herself inside out in some ways to get there for Johnny. But then she'd met Frank. Help us with this odd triangle, because Johnny was this beneficent force, and then he becomes kind of a force that she's running from. She does not want to meet up with him.
Yet, for some reason, I never found the inclination to tell Frank about Johnny Golden and how it was he who had asked me to come ultimately to San Antonio. Much less that he planned to meet me there, something I had nearly forgotten myself and had long ago begun both to doubt and even to dread. But still, there had been no word or sign from Johnny since Detroit, so that I now felt sure he must have perished in the war.
She realizes that she should have told Frank about Johnny Golden. She should have told him in San Antonio, she should have said up front that there had been this man in her past and he had wanted to meet up with her and she didn't know what had happened to him or if he was still alive or not. And she realizes that by not having told him that, when Johnny arrives, it's suddenly going to become clear that she's held that from him and it's going to be very awkward. But there's nothing she can do about it at this point.
What were you doing there? She's very conflicted. Help me with that moment when she decides, I'm not going to wait for Johnny in this town.
Yeah, when she finds that he is at that point in New Orleans and planning on heading to San Antonio where he has heard that she has moved, she immediately just rushes to basically to pack up and leave and hopes that she can somehow shake his trail. You know, and of course, he's determined to find her and is able to pursue her. But she doesn't yet know where Frank has gone.
Right.
You know, he had just said he was going to go to the Fort Concho, which is now San Angelo, a new fort at the time, and he had heard that there was great gambling to be had there and
right.
with the soldiers, and that she could find him in the frontier fort circuit.
He shows her he's been there for.
So this is, she's gotten to the beehive,
right.
and she's waiting outside, and she's about to go in because she knows Frank is in there after this long journey.
I rushed across the street, dodging various livestock and the shout of buggy drivers and riders on horseback, until I stopped just beyond the awning-covered entrance to read what appeared to be a poem painted in ornate gold letters. It read,
"Within this hive, we're all alive. Good whiskey makes us funny. If you are dry, step in and try the flavor of our honey."
It was now on the cusp of night, and a warm yellow light poured outside from within the saloon, along with the sound of a lone fiddle screeching out some unrecognizable tune. But the din of voices, both male and female, punctuated with uproarious laughter, felt oddly welcoming. So I took a deep breath, pushed the swing doors to, and stepped inside.
So it's the beehive, and we're coming to one climactic scene. Doc Holliday shows up. Johnny shows up.
Yeah.
Everybody shows up.
Various sources recount how Doc Holliday turns up at Fort Griffin, and there's this epic faro match where Frank has bet the house that he can defeat Doc Holliday.
He's bet the beehive.
He's the whole beehive. Everything they have, everything that Frank and Lottie have at this point, and all of her hopes. So Frank makes this drunken bet with Doc Holliday, and Doc suggests that they bet the whole beehive saloon on it, and all the money that Frank has.
It was now 10-1 that Frank would win. But when the next card showed an ace, the watching crowd gasped.
And he agrees. And when Lottie finds out, she's furious. She tries to get him to go back on it, but he says, "We shook on it, you know, gentleman's handshake." And then he loses the Doc Holliday. Loses it all.
The bank was broke. And to signify as much, Frank turned his box on its side, counted out $40,000 to Doc, and got up from the dealer's chair. Doc said,
"You look about as happy as a bulldog chewing on a wasp."
I got that line. I was up in Eureka Springs years ago, and I heard someone say that. He looked about as happy as a bulldog chewing on a wasp, and the image of that. And I thought, I have to use that sometime. So.
There were two conversations that night. Ours was flirtation, theirs was a fight.
But before that, Lottie has told Frank, you know, that you've got to make one condition with Doc. You've got to tell him that if he wins, I get a chance to play him, you know, to sit behind the box, the faro box. And so And that leads to this really epic match between Lottie and Doc Holliday. And it's based on real life events that were recounted by different people from the time. What inspired me was reading the fictional account of that as portrayed by Alfred Henry Lewis in his books.
As you sail on the boat on the back of your dime, if I had the chance, I would hand you a branch from the back of mine.
Apparently Frank had told some of these stories to him and that he had used in the book, and she did not like, you know, being depicted, you know, accurately, as it, you know, probably, but nevertheless, she was trying to get beyond. At this point, they're in New Mexico, and they had a ranch, and they sat around at the ranch.
Yeah, she was a nice church woman.
And Frank's sitting around drinking with this writer, who's a journalist, and he's writing these stories and spilling the beans, really, about all this stuff that she was trying to hide and get beyond, because they took their real names again once they got to New Mexico. So when she saw the way she was depicted, you know, her earlier lifestyle, really, she was not happy with that.
If I had just walked down the stairs, if I wasn't so shy and embarrassed in that.
For over 20 years now, I have devoted my life primarily to my circle of loyal friends and to my church. I also teach a popular Sunday school class, where I include lessons in Hebrew based on my memory of studying it at the Episcopal convent of my youth. I even helped form a new social club in 1912 that counts many of the most prominent women in Deming as members. It is called the Golden Gossip Club, and to this day I have never missed a single weekly luncheon meeting. We gather on Tuesdays to play bridge with matchsticks on my front porch. I always win.
And the tradition continued. So you had the early radio plays of Gunsmoke. You had Miss Kitty was clearly based on her. And, you know, redhead. And then any Western fan knows Gunfight at the OK Corral. And there's a character there named Laura Denbo. So earlier in the century, she was well known, and a number of characters were based on her in the movies and also literature. And so what I'm hoping with this novel is to capture her story, you know, for, you know, a contemporary audience.
If I could, I'd pack your town upon my back. I wouldn't have to keep on holding back.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to the following musicians and singers: Brian Nolan. And a special thanks to Millie Raccoon for the amazing music that conjured up the American West. Thanks to musicians Sam Brown and Frank Thurmond for the ballad. Thanks to actors Frank Thurmond, Drew DeFrance, Michael Fuller, Bobby Fuller, and Millie Raccoon as Lottie Dina. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to Chris Hickey for the sound effects and for helping to mix and for mastering the episode. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Frank Thurmond for your historical novel that took us from Kentucky to Detroit, down the Mississippi to New Orleans, San Antone, and out to the Western frontier. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Charles Portis. You must pay for everything in this world one way or another. There is nothing free except the grace of God. You cannot earn that or deserve it. Arts and Letters is a production of Living the Dream Media.